Good morning. We're going to call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Today's Wednesday, the 8th of March, 2006. It's now 8:34 a.m., and we have Senator Guest, Senator French, myself, and Senator Huggins. We're going to start today with Senate Bill 206. I see the sponsor is with us this morning. Welcome, Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I have another simple little bill for you. Mr. Chairman, you have a CS, I believe.
We do. We have CS before us, / golf.
And you'd like to adopt
that as your correct one? Document? That you that is, well, you do agree that that's the one we want to adopt?
I think so.
Chair would entertain a motion to adopt.
Yes, CS.
Motion's been made by Senator Huggins. Is there objection? We'll adopt it and ask you to explain the changes.
Mr. Chairman, now that you adopted, I also acknowledge that all legislation is work in progress, and there may be, as we go through judiciary, some additional information you want that comes to light that you want to see if it would strengthen the bill, and I look forward to that. Just briefly, as in way of introduction, I'd like to think this isn't special interest legislation, but it came to my attention, excuse me, last fall when there was an incident in Anchorage at a mall, and basically a gang battle of shooting, and some of the participants in this shooting, on the victim's side, basically blew off the cops, said, don't want to talk to you, don't need to talk to you, called a cab, said, we're out of here, we'll take care of this ourselves. I've talked since then to our chief of police, and he would not only, of course, like to encourage these people to cooperate with the police, but would like to have an opportunity for some kind of cooling off period as well, because in this case that I referenced, shortly thereafter, there was another incident, and there was this, you know, retribution going on among gang members. I was surprised, amazed to find out that there isn't a material witness bill in Alaska, and think that this is another tool that law enforcement should have at their disposal, understanding the need to balance the rights of our citizens, law-abiding citizens, versus the need to try and control crime. So in summary, what we have here is this sets guidelines and protections for issuing a material witness order in Alaska, allows a prosecuting attorney or defendant to apply to the Superior Court to... I need to shift gears to the CS. It allows, and I was also surprised that if a police officer asked for your identification in the past, if you were at a crime scene or something, you didn't have to give it to him. And this bill would require that you identify yourself. So it allows for temporary detention and identification of people who are can be considered by a police officer to have reasonable suspicion that they have recently committed or are committing or about to commit a crime or witnessed or was at the scene or in the vicinity during the commission of a crime against a person or a felony property crime, and that that person may have material information that aid in the investigation, and that temporary detention is a reasonable necessity to obtain and verify identification of the person, to obtain an account of the crime, and to protect the crime victim from imminent harm. Go back again to this gray line between constitutionally protected rights and the need to for law enforcement's ability to protect us and prosecute crime. But this person who is temporarily detained shall permit one or more photographs to be taken of themselves if the officer requested, shall verify their identity. Of course, they're not required to answer any other questions. If a person does not verify the identity by showing the police officer a valid government-issued photographic ID, the officer then may fingerprint the person. As I said, the person retained under this bill would not be required to answer any questions. You know, they certainly have their Miranda rights, but a police officer could elect to serve a subpoena on that person to detain them as a material witness. And it does state that a person would commit a crime of interfering with a police officer if they resist or refuse to allow the taking of the pictures or the photograph. I think that's the summary of the CS, Mr. Chairman. Now, let me ask Lauren if something she'd like to add.
For the record, my name is Lauren Rice, and I'm staff to Senator Bundy. The CS, we worked with Department of Law to create the CS, and Dean Guanelli should be online. There are a few things in the CS when you first look at it that might cause you a little bit of, get a little bit nervous. For instance, on page 2, line 4, has recently committed, is committing, or is about to commit a crime. That could be an issue for some people, but there is case law to support that this has been, there's statute in other states that has been adopted, and there's case law that defines temporarily detained, and then there's case law that defines is about to commit a crime. So for instance, if you would not be able to detain someone who was simply didn't look like they should be in a certain neighborhood, it would have to be literally on the phone saying he's about to kill his wife, and then he goes and starts driving towards her home. It would be a situation more like that. But like I said before, Dean Guanelli is online, and he can speak to the details and the statute in other states that support this CS.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Questions, Senator? Yes.
Thank you. Senator Bundy had talked about Miranda rights, and not being an attorney, and maybe Senator French can answer this. If, does someone have Miranda rights if they're just being temporarily detained? And how are they going to know that they're not required to answer the questions that are being posed to them? I'm not sure when Miranda kicks in. All I know is what I watch on Law and Order, and I don't necessarily take that as.
I think Law and Order is very accurate on this. They always Mirandize someone when you're arrested, when you're no longer free to leave. That's okay. You've got to be. It's pertains to custodial interrogation. Those two things. You have to be in custody. It has to be something that was elicited through the result of the interrogation.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I may have been overly broad when I said Miranda. It was kind of a term of art, I guess, for me. But to go to your other question, how do you know you don't have to answer questions? Well, the same way we know now that we don't have to answer questions, it's the whole right from self-incrimination, that if we are detained by a police officer, we don't have to answer questions, but we can then be subject to arrest if there's probable cause. I'm not sure that how else we notify people other than they have to be cognizant of their rights, I guess, that currently exist, and this wouldn't change that.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, and obviously I'm dangerously over my depth here, and I would defer to Dean Guanelli on the technical questions.
I was going to save my
Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, to save my legal nitpicking for Mr. Guanelli, but I just wanted to ask the sponsor. We had a bill that looked like kind of a piece of model legislation, if you will, from other states. I think that was the one question I asked you at the last hearing, and my brief amount of study on that seemed to bear that out. It looked like a pretty comprehensive bill with sort of well laid out procedure for what you do with these witnesses and so forth, and going in front of a judge. And this seems like a far different piece, and I'm just kind of curious as to how we got from that one to this one.
Yeah, the other one, I guess, would be model, but it was, I don't know if awkward is the appropriate term, but it was not effective in achieving what at least the police in Anchorage had hoped to achieve, which was saying, will you chat with me for a few minutes, or I, of course, can get a subpoena if you want, versus the whole thing where then you have to put them up in a hotel and go through the whole judge thing. Again, very concerned about helping law enforcement be effective and not endangering or unfairly treating the citizen in the gang-related thing. You take them under the old bill into custody as material witness, whether they talk or not, they're assumed to be a snitch, and we might actually endanger their lives, certainly in some domestic violence situations that could be dangerous. This seemed to achieve the goal of encouraging people to be cooperative as a material witness without all the encumbrances that the other bill had, and my goal was to make something that works without being so burdensome and expensive that might not ever be used or might not make it through the system.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions? We'll get to Mr. Gonnell here in a minute. My couple of things, I've always assumed that if I was not under arrest, I was free to leave. Other than a scene of an accident, which I can think of, but I could see how this could be easily abused. Let's take a hunting camp. A state trooper walks into the hunting camp and says, "I have reason to believe that you guys have been hunting, or you have shot something and you don't have it in camp, or whatever. Now I want to take all your pictures. I want to see all your IDs." And I want to fingerprint those of you that don't have IDs. The rednecks that live in my neck of the woods are going to have a real problem with that. You know, if there's a legitimate crime that has been committed and we're trying to identify material witnesses, that's one thing. But how this could be applied is where some of my concern comes in, because it gives a tool to the police officer, yes. A tire iron can be used for many things, including taking a tire off of a wheel off of a vehicle, or hitting someone over the head. And I guess my concern, and maybe we should talk with Mr. Gonnelli a little bit about that, is that we aren't creating a tire iron that will be used for hitting people over the head.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just point out on page 2, in line 7, I believe it is, this is in the commission of a crime against a person or a felony property crime. So in your scenario, would not apply. Again, you know, that challenge of how do we get the bad guys but not encumber the good guys goes on, and I will acknowledge that whatever law we make, someone can misuse at some time, so I'd like to think that the vast majority of the times it will be used for the proper purposes.
Yeah, and that's the hardest part, is that I understand that, you know, no person is forced to make any inculpatory or exculpatory statements, no confessions or admissions, as they don't have to do that. I don't think most people understand where their rights kick in. And I think that's part of the problem. Most people watch TV and they figure that's where what their legal rights are, and some of those are very correct. But maybe we'll just get to questions for Mr. Glinelli. There, and you're right, Lauren, in that it does give some concern about someone who's in the vicinity of a crime. In the vicinity of that crime, you know, if my next-door neighbor's shot, do I have to have my picture taken? Do I have to have my fingerprints? Do I have to show my ID? And I know that people are going to say, wait a minute, is this the United States of America or is it not, you know, when we're there? I know that's going to be part of it, and I see what you're trying to get at. But someone who says, well, geez, I'm not going to let you come in and take my picture, well, you can either do that or you can go to jail for impeding or for interfering with a peace officer. And I understand where we're going. It's just where that tool in the hands of a responsible individual is what I think could be useful. I'm not sure that at all times everybody acts responsibly when they have a big tool in their hand.
I think we could, Mr. Chairman, look at the Second Amendment that way. Mm-hmm. We have to put up with a few idiots so the rest of us have rights. I think in law enforcement we may have to put up with a few idiots so that we have effective law enforcement.
I'd like to get rid of the idiots.
Well, well, I would join you in that.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Mr. Glinelli. Mr. Glinelli, are you there this morning?
I am, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. If you'll introduce yourself for the record, sir.
Thank you. My name is Dean Glinelli, Chief Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the Department of Law.
Mr. Glinelli, your comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, let me try to explain how we got to this CS, how we got the version of the bill to this point. The original version of the bill, as Senator French indicated, set up a fairly elaborate system of dealing with material witnesses, people who have information about crimes. It was my view when looking at that original version that I had some questions about whether we actually could go as far as that bill did, which it essentially allowed police to take witnesses into custody. So in thinking about those concerns and then listening to Anchorage Police Chief Monaghan's testimony in the House side, in the companion bill introduced by Representative Meyer, his testimony was that the system set out in the original bill was perhaps a little more than they really needed in Anchorage, and what they really wanted was simply an opportunity to talk to people who may have information about serious crimes that recently were committed. So I was present in Senator Bundy's office when we spoke with Chief Monaghan on the phone, and he reiterated his concerns. And at Senator Bundy's request, I started taking a look at what we might be able to do short of the original version of the bill, which allowed witnesses to be arrested, yet still met Chief Monaghan's concern about just being able to find out who these people are who may have witnessed a serious crime. And in doing that, I thought it would be best to start with the law that related to what police can do with respect to people who they suspect of committing a crime, because that law is more developed than the law regarding what police can do with mere witnesses to crimes. And the law is fairly well developed and gives police officers the authority to temporarily detain someone who they believe they have reasonable suspicion to believe may have committed a crime or are about to commit a crime. This proposition goes back almost 40 years to a landmark United States Supreme Court opinion called Terry versus Ohio in the late 1960s that gave the police that right. Now, the Supreme Court in that opinion wasn't precise about how long the police could detain them and exactly what circumstances would give rise to the right to detain, and that has developed over the years. But the notion that the police, short of having probable cause to actually make an arrest, that they are still able to temporarily stop someone, find out what they're doing, is well developed in the law of this country, and it's something that police recruits all over the country learn and are trained about, and this is called a Terry stop after the Supreme Court opinion Terry versus Ohio, and the police know when they're able to make a Terry stop, and they generally have some sense of how long they can detain the person and what they can do. It very much depends on the circumstances of the case, how serious the crime that has been committed or that they suspect was about to be committed, and it's a balancing test, and the courts are fairly used to reviewing those situations. Over the years, the courts imposed at some point some restrictions on what the police could do in making Terry stops, and more recently the courts have loosened up on some of those restrictions. In particular, 2 years ago the United States Supreme Court in a case involving a Nevada statute actually held that Nevada could constitutionally make it a crime for a person who was stopped legitimately in a Terry stop under reasonable suspicion that they have committed or were about to commit a crime. The state of Nevada could make it a crime for that person to refuse to give their name to the police. Now, that's one slight loosening of the restrictions on the police. In Alaska, it was once the law that the police could only make one of these Terry stops for a crime that involved a significant danger to a person or significant danger to the public. More recently, the Alaska Court of Appeals has loosened up on that, and I think it's simply a reflection of what we know about the nature of crime today. And the Alaska Court of Appeals has said, well, as long as the police have reasonable suspicion that any crime may have been committed or was about to be committed, that gives the, it doesn't have to be one that's a significant danger to a person. As long as if the legislature has decreed that conduct to be a crime, then the police, if they have reasonable suspicion to believe that it has been committed, they can stop that person and ask questions. So that's the general law with respect to these so-called Terry stops of suspects. The Alaska Court of Appeals has also said the detention has to be brief and only so long as it allows the police officer to ask them questions and see if they can find out any information. The person doesn't have to answer the questions, but you at least give the officer an opportunity to see if they can find out what's going on. The Alaska Court of Appeals has also said this detention has got to be at the vicinity where the person is detained, in which you can't remove the person to another place. So that's the law with respect to suspects, and you can imagine that the law with respect to stopping mere witnesses to a crime involves further restrictions on the police, and that indeed is the case. Now, before I get to that, let me just pause and see if there are any questions about the general law regarding temporarily detaining suspects.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Senator Bundy.
I'm expected to make a quorum at finance, so I'll leave you in Lauren's able hands, and thank you for
being here this morning. Appreciate it. Questions for Mr. Bonelli at this point? Just Senator French?
Just briefly. Good morning, Dean. It's Hollis French here in Juneau. The Terry case, that was originally a case in which the Supreme Court said it was okay for a police officer at the scene to pat down the outer clothing of a suspect for purposes of officer safety, to make certain that person didn't have a gun or a knife or some other object that he could injure the police officer with. Is that your memory of the Terry case?
Through the chair, the Terry case certainly involved the authority of the police, once they have legitimately stopped and detained a person, to also take necessary actions for their own safety, which is to briefly pat down the person, just frisk them for weapons. But the case involves really both concepts, the authority to briefly detain and the authority of the officer to protect themselves by a brief frisk.
And I guess my other point is that, and this is as much a point for everybody that's listening as for you, but I guess I'm just asking you to be as careful as you can, because it's easy, I think, in this setting to confuse suspects with witnesses. There's a significant difference, of course, between someone who's, the police believe is committing a crime, and someone who is a wholly innocent bystander who's in the vicinity, who may or may not have seen that crime being committed or about to be committed. And I guess just as an example, in the Heibel case, the Supreme Court case you mentioned out of Nevada, the issue was, at least my reading of the case was that, the issue is, may a suspect, may the person who's suspected of being of committing a crime, be compelled to identify himself simply by giving his name? And of course, as you accurately told us, the answer is yes, he can be compelled to identify himself by giving his name, but the case didn't involve, of course, any issue of government ID or fingerprinting. So I guess I just think it's important to keep witnesses apart from suspects, and to be aware of the degree to which we're, I guess, expanding some of the concepts that are embedded in law today.
Through the chair, I think that's what I'm trying to do, and my analysis started with the law regarding stops of suspects, and then proceeded to the law regarding stops of witnesses, and I'm trying to keep those two distinct, and I think the statute does that. But if I might, let me go on briefly to the law regarding stopping of witnesses to a crime.
Go ahead.
And there is there's a group called the American Law Institute, which adopts model laws, mostly related to criminal justice. And in fact, one of the model laws, the Model Penal Code, is what was adopted in Alaska in 1980 as our criminal code. And Model Penal Code has been adopted in quite a number of states. So American Law Institute is a well-respected legal think tank, if you will, that considers and adopts model laws for consideration by state legislatures. The American Law Institute has another model law. It's called the Model Law of Pre-Arraignment Procedure, which governs arrests and stops and things like that. And one of the provisions in that model law is a provision that permits the police to stop witnesses of crimes, people who have information that may be of material aid in the investigation of a crime. And that model law actually has been cited a couple of times by the courts in Alaska, once by the Alaska Court of Appeals, once by the Alaska Supreme Court, and I think it's fair to say that the law has been cited with approval. In other words, they've cited this as an indication of what is good policy and good law in the area. And that is what this bill adopts, is essentially the Model Code of Pre-Arraignment Procedure provision, which has been cited with approval by the Alaska Court of Appeals and the Alaska Supreme Court, and to provide clear authority for the police to temporarily detain a witness at the scene of a crime, nearby a crime that has been recently committed, if they believe that that person has information that may be of material aid to the police. Naturally, the authority of the police to deal with that witness is going to be much less extensive than their authority to deal with suspects, which is, you know, in itself is fairly limited. But with that as background, if we could turn to the work draft provision, and on page 2 of that, in subsection A1, we have the concept of essentially the Terry versus Ohio temporary detention of suspects, which is set out here. And this is the language that I believe was involved in the Nevada statute that the U.S. Supreme Court approved in the case that Senator French indicated. And just so you understand why I thought it was a good idea to include law regarding suspects and law regarding stops of witnesses is that I think when the police come upon a shooting, particularly involving gangs, they are going to encounter a variety of individuals, some of whom they suspect will have been involved in the actual shooting, some of whom may be innocent bystanders who may just have information, and some of whom may be gang members who may have peripheral involvement, one way or the other. I think it's important for the police to have the rules set out in one place for distinguishing between those people they might stop and have reasonable cause to believe that they are a suspect in the crime, as opposed to those who they might stop and talk to because they think they have information. So I thought it was important that both provisions be set out here, and that's why this is the suggestion here in this work draft. In any event, subsection A1 is the standard for which has really existed in law for almost 40 years. Subsection A2 is the provision involving the American Law Institute Model Code of Pre-Arraignment Procedure provision for witnesses. Now, there have been some slight wording changes here. I think the legislative drafter added a couple of concepts, but the primary concept is that it's a crime against person. In other words, a shooting, a stabbing, an assault of some type, or a felony property crime, and that would be burglary, arson, something of a more serious nature, and that the person may have information of material aid in the investigation of that crime, and further that the temporary detention is reasonably necessary to obtain or verify the identification of the person. That's straight out of the Model Code of Pre-Arraignment Procedure. To obtain an account of the crime, again, straight out of the Model Code. To protect a crime victim from imminent harm, this comes from a Alaska Court of Appeals opinion where they permitted a stop for a stop of a witness, actually a victim for that purpose, or for other exigent circumstances, which is the phrase used by the Alaska Court of Appeals by the Alaska Supreme Court in specifying when the police can detain a mere witness to a crime. That is, that there has to be something, some exigency, some immediate reason for doing so. So these are the provisions, and I think it's...
Let's stop here for a minute.
Sure.
This is Senator Zekins. I think all of those are ors, not ands. Am I correct?
First of all, I think the first, the drafting of this probably would have been clearer if it had been set out in separate subparagraphs, but the person was at the scene or in the vicinity. That's one provision. During the commission of a crime against person or the felony property crime. That's the second. And the person may have information or material aid in the investigation. And the temporary detention is reasonably necessary for one of the following four reasons. And then the final four reasons for why the temporary detention is necessary, those are all or. So it's a little bit awkwardly worded.
The way it's drafted, I see ors everywhere.
It is awkward the way it's worded. And once I saw it finally come out in its final form, I realized that that setting it out in separate subparagraphs would make it much clearer, and I think much less scary, if you will.
Yeah, because I don't see a single and in there, you know, as far as those different things are concerned. And so I think it should be drafted a little more clearly.
I completely agree with you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, go ahead. Can you give us an example of an exigent circumstance?
I think that exigent circumstances is the catch-all phrase that is intended to allow for unusual circumstances that make it hard for me to come up with an example right off the top of my head right now.
Senator French, maybe you can help us there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just happen to have a case in front of me that's got at least the model code's definition of exigent circumstances. And it says that the model code supports requiring exigent circumstances for the stop of a witness. It takes the position that an officer may detain a witness only when a serious crime occurred recently, the officer reasonably believes that the witness's information will materially assist in the investigation, and the detention is necessary. That's what I get out of that.
Okay. So we're talking about some of those things in the paragraph above.
Serious crime, reasonable belief that the witness's information will assist, and the detention is necessary.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Guarnelli.
I think that if you then go down to going down to paragraph B, paragraph B then tells the police what they can do in connection with a suspect of a crime who's been detained under A1, and that is, of course, they can take the person's photograph. They can ask for identification. Now, what the U.S. Supreme Court has held is that you can actually make it a crime for them to refuse to give a name. But even if they give a name, that often is not their true name. And so this goes one step further and says that they can verify their name or they can verify their identity by showing a driver's license or other government identification. Or if they don't have one, if they say they don't have one, or if they don't want to give one, the police officer can take fingerprints from the person, again, to identify that person. If that can be done without unreasonable delay and without unreasonably removing the person from the vicinity. I think what's intended here is that the police have an ink pad in their patrol car, and they go to their patrol car and get that and take the person's fingerprints. That's fine, but in conformity with what the Alaska Court of Appeals has held, that you can't remove a person, a suspect, from the vicinity. They couldn't, for example, take the person downtown or take them to the station. They have to do that right at the scene. So I think this tries to balance the needs of the police to obtain a definite identity of a person they suspect of a crime. Certainly, if we could constitutionally make it a crime to refuse to give the name, then it seems like even a lesser intrusion to actually go ahead and ask for identification or take fingerprints of the person.
Let me ask you.
But admittedly, this is going a bit further than other cases have. Or let's put it this way: there is not a court opinion that specifically approves this, this procedure. On the other hand, I don't know of one that specifically disapproves it as well.
Mr. Guinelli, let's go back another step. I have another question here.
Sure.
In that regard. Okay. Let's look at how this is drafted in Section A. It says a police officer may temporarily detain a person under circumstances to give the officer reasonable suspicion that the person, one, has recently committed, is committing, or is about to commit a crime, or witnessed or was at the scene or in the vicinity during the commission of a crime against the person or a felony property crime. As I see this law is drafted, or this bill is drafted, this is not restricted or limited to crimes against a person or a felony crime. It's against, if I read A1 and it's an or at the end of that subparagraph, that this is for any crime this could be enacted. Am I correct?
Mr. Chairman, the provision under A1 where the officer has reasonable suspicion that the person has recently committed, is committing, or about to commit a crime, that applies to any crime. However, the provision under A2, that the person is a mere witness to the crime, that only applies to crimes against persons, assaults, shootings, that sort of thing, or a serious crime against property. In other words, for a mere shoplifting or something like that, the police cannot detain witnesses to that offense. It has to be something much more serious than that. But you're correct that with respect to suspects of crimes, and this is again in conformance with a last Court of Appeals opinion, that any crime the legislature has declared conduct to be serious enough to be a crime, and the police have reasonable suspicion that a person has committed that offense, they have the authority to detain that person.
And this is new in law in the state of Alaska now?
No, I believe that this is a statement of the current case law in Alaska.
They can't, but in current case law, they can't take photographs, they can't take fingerprints,
true.
They can't do all the other things that are there.
Well, let's put it this way. I'm not sure that they can't take photographs of a person who is detained in public. I think that is something that...
Let's say they can't require them to have their photograph taken or be arrested or be charged with interfering with a peace officer.
Correct. All of that is new law, but the provision under A1 recognizing the authority of the police to detain a person under those circumstances, that I believe is a statement of current existing Alaska law. I think you only know about that from reading the cases or going through a police academy.
So in effect, beyond the material witness side of it, we're casting a much bigger loop here than we have in current law.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe that this allows the police to detain anyone additional, suspects of crimes, as you said, not witnesses. I don't believe this allows the police to detain any additional suspects of crimes that they are not able to detain currently under Alaska law.
Okay, but it does add to the threat. If you don't let me take your photograph, if you don't let me fingerprint you, if you don't have, let me show you, you have to show me your government ID, and if you don't do that, I'm going to fingerprint you, and if you resist me at all, I'm going to charge you with interfering with a police officer, even if there was no crime, but he suspected that they were about to commit a crime.
To the extent that the person is lawfully detained as a suspect of a crime, this allows the police to obtain positive identification of that person at the scene.
Okay.
And that's essentially all that it does is gets positive identification at the scene rather than sometime later.
Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Guarnelli, I was just thinking about this because, you know, I've got, on the one hand, I've got Senator Seekins's hunting camp example in my mind that I hadn't thought of till this morning, and that's troubling to me that a fishing game officer could walk into a hunting camp and say, you know, I think you guys are getting ready to cross a boundary here and hunt in a closed area, so let's have your IDs and fingerprints you. On the other hand, I know about, you know, the Diamond Center is not far from where I live, and you know, it's just wrong for people to leave the scene of a crime when they know something and just flat don't want to cooperate. I'm trying to strike a middle ground here somewhere. What
do all your officers have cameras in their cars? I mean, digital cameras are $200 a whack now, almost anywhere you go. And you know, I hate to put one more thing on their tool belt, but I mean, it just seems like police officers, when they get to the scene of a crime, ought to be snapping pictures left and right. And the chairman just took one out of his pocket, Mr. Guarnelli, just to let you know. You know, because I agree, if you're in public, your photograph is open, you know, open season. A lot of crimes are solved by going back and looking at the closed circuit television monitors that security operations run all over the country and indeed are more common now in public. So I'm just wondering whether there isn't some way to get this without the sort of coercive power of detention and possible criminal charges if you don't cooperate.
Through the chair, Senator French and actually Senator Seekins, the hunting camp scenario is an interesting one, but I'm not certain that it would rise to the level of justifying a stop of someone about to commit a crime under the case law in the United States. The catchphrase used by the U.S. Supreme Court in the old Terry opinion was that criminal activity is afoot. In other words, this is the cat burglar. You know, it's not casing out some place to break into, is actually, you know, lurking right beneath the window with burglar tools in the middle of the night. It's that kind of imminence that is required by the case law, and to that extent, if the idea of imminence is I think that is reflected in the case law, and I certainly have no problem with, you know, putting in something, you know, that concept into the statute, because I don't think that that hunters, you know, sitting around in a hunting camp would ever present the kind of circumstances that would allow the police to, you know, to stop them and take their IDs. I just don't see that happening.
I'm trying to find out where that balance point is there too, because it's I can imagine it happening because having run into a few people in the field, mainly federal officers that have sometimes try to use intimidation to force people outside of their constitutional rights. But the
Mr. Chairman, what we certainly don't want to do is take away any authority that the police have under current law to detain suspects, and I certainly have gotten a clear message that the committee doesn't want to expand upon those rights.
Well, we might if there was a good reason to do that. I mean, I think, Dean, the reason we're asking the questions is we see the exigency of your circumstances, but we want to make sure that we don't, you know, like I said earlier, a tire iron can be used for many purposes. We'd like to make sure that this is a tire iron used to remove flat tires, and not just to hit somebody over the head.
Right.
So I think that's where at least that's where I'm just trying to get my arms around it. I see why there needs to be the ability to be able to retain someone you know, who has recently committed a crime or is committing a crime, or where it's where criminal activity is afoot, and to find out who they are and what they're doing, or even in this in the circumstances of a material witness. I guess at the same time, we don't want to make we want to make sure that we are not making it easy to use that tire iron for the wrong purpose. That's
sure.
all. And I hope you understand that.
I do, and I'll certainly take those comments to heart, in thinking about ways to limit the language in the work draft without necessarily tying the hands of the police. And I think this is a good discussion.
I think we need to take a look at paragraph A2, though, and how and get that maybe drafted a little bit more clearly.
I, Mr. Chairman, I completely agree with that. And when I saw the final wording of this, it I realized that that's something that that would be necessary.
Okay. Other discussion. We stopped you there at the end of 2B, I think.
Well, then to distinguish what authority the police have with respect to suspects of crimes, then subsection C tells the police what they can do with respect to witnesses of crimes. And essentially what this does is this tries to meet Chief Monaghan's concern about giving police the authority to just, you know, stop someone and say, hey, you know, who are you? You know, what can you tell us? What happened? I mean, certainly there's no requirement that a person provide any information, but even if the police are able to simply identify that person, that is that's a great assistance that then a week later when things have calmed down, they can re-interview the person and hopefully get some information. So this subsection C provision tells the police what they can do with respect to witnesses. And ultimately, it's the obligation of every citizen to provide testimony in court, unless they have a legal privilege not to provide testimony. And there are a number of privileges that someone might have, but the way that any party, whether it's the defense or prosecution, civil or criminal cases, obtains the testimony of a person is by issuing them a subpoena. That can be done at any time, and in fact, the practice of some police agencies, including some in Alaska, is that in certain types of cases, to issue a subpoena to a person right on the spot. This occurs most often. Pardon me.
Go ahead. No one said anything.
This occurs most often in domestic violence cases where the police are called to a domestic violence dispute, they arrest the offender, and then at that moment they issue a subpoena to the victim of the crime. What that does in the domestic violence context is it allows the victim to say, you know, I've got to testify, I can't get out of it. I've been ordered by this subpoena to appear in court and testify, and it gives them some ability to resist the inevitable pressure that domestic violence abusers bring toward victims of their crimes to recant, to not show up for trial. This allows them to say, "Look, I've been subpoenaed. It's out of my hands now." This provision in subsection C expands on that notion, the ability of the police to issue a subpoena, and gives them the authority to issue a subpoena if they don't even know who the person is. They take a photograph of the person, they issue them a subpoena. The subpoena does not contain their name, but does direct them to appear in front of the grand jury in conformity with the obligation of citizens to provide testimony in court.
Okay, let me ask you a question here then, if I could. This is Senator Seekins again. On line 22, it says the officer elects to serve a subpoena. Is there a difference between serving a subpoena and issuing a subpoena?
Mr. Chairman, serving a subpoena is actually handing it to the person by someone officially designated to serve subpoenas, and that would be, in this case, a peace officer or a process server. Actually, issuing the subpoena is something that the courts do, and
only an officer of the court can issue a subpoena. Am I correct?
Only a subpoenas are issued either by judges or by clerks of the court. So only an official court court employee who's designated by the court to issue subpoenas can do that. But as a practical matter, they are freely available to parties on both sides, and those parties then give the subpoenas to someone who is lawfully empowered to serve the subpoena.
So my question here is, a police officer is a member of the administration, is not a member of the, is not an officer or an employee of the court.
Correct.
And we're going to give him, that person, the issue, the ability here to serve the subpoena or to issue the subpoena, and if they're to serve the subpoena, who issued it?
Mr. Chairman, the subpoenas are issued by the court, but they are generally available. Blank subpoenas are generally available to any party who can pick them up, fill them out, and give them to a process server.
Okay.
The practice, as I understand it, in Anchorage right now with the Anchorage Police Department is in domestic violence cases to actually serve subpoenas on the victim of the offense.
The reason I ask that question is because as you were talking about this, you were saying the police officer would issue a subpoena.
I'm sorry, that was a mistake in terminology. The police officer serves the subpoena that has been issued by the court.
I wanted to make sure that we were clear on the wording there. Thank you.
And this notion of serving the subpoena is something that I think is current practice in domestic violence cases in Anchorage. But in those cases, the police officer almost always gets the identity of the person right there who's the victim of the crime, who's usually called the police in the first place. A more unusual circumstance where Chief Monaghan and his investigators, particularly in some of these shootings involving gangs, doesn't know who these witnesses are. They don't provide identification, and this statute doesn't even require that they do so. But it does recognize the authority of the officer to serve a subpoena. The subpoena doesn't have to contain the name. The police officer would be well advised, obviously, to snap a quick picture so they can prove that this is the person they issued the subpoena to.
Let me ask you another question here on this paragraph and also on B. We've said here twice that the person is not required to answer questions, but we said that they have to verify their identity. Are we saying that a person should not have to is not required to answer questions except as to verification of identity?
Mr. Chairman, I think that what this says is that the person is not compelled to speak any words at all, but in response to a request by the police officer to say to provide identification, they reach into their wallet and pull out their driver's license. In the case of the suspect, that they may have their fingerprints taken, but they simply aren't required to speak any words. Some courts and some judges believe that forcing someone to speak words is raises some concerns under the Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate yourself. The majority of the U.S. Supreme Court discounted that notion in the Heibel versus Nevada case that Senator French mentioned. But in order to allay the concerns of some judges that someone is required to speak this work draft specifically says that they are not. And that's the reason for it.
Senator French?
Thank you, Mr. Quinnell. I was just looking at that case, and I totally agree with your reading of it. But it's you're sort of on the horns of a dilemma here, because there are times when simply saying your name can be incriminating. And as the Heibel case pointed out, that case didn't involve that sort of scenario, so it didn't reach that question of whether there might be situations in which simply uttering your name would be sort of contrary to your Fifth Amendment privilege not to incriminate yourself. I think in 99% of the cases, that's not a problem. But if you avoid that dilemma by going straight to the driver's license production, as the Heibel case pointed out, that statute didn't require a suspect to give the officer a driver's license or other document. And later on in the case, they pointed out that production of identity documents might meet the definition of an assertion of identity. And they go on to say that acts of production may yield testimony establishing, quote, the existence, authenticity, and custody of items that the police seek. You may inadvertently reveal something to the police by pulling out your wallet, opening it up, and extracting your driver's license. There may be something else in there that they see that leads them to the next step in a criminal investigation. So I mean, we're just in an area full of minefields, I guess, is my point.
Through the chair, Senator French, I guess I don't read the U.S. Supreme Court opinion in that way. What the majority of the justices found was that requiring someone to speak their name does not, except in very, very unusual circumstances, implicate any Fifth Amendment rights. And what they said was, if those rare cases ever get to us, we will deal with those when they come up. But it was really almost a hypothetical, theoretical scenario where speaking your name would implicate Fifth Amendment rights. And really, I believe it's the same with producing identification documents. They weren't talking about what the police might see when you open your wallet. What they were talking about was a very theoretical situation where, by the fact that you have a driver's license, that may somehow implicate you in crime. And frankly, I cannot envision a set of circumstances where that might come into play, and the U.S. Supreme Court didn't either. They said that if one of those rare cases came to them, they would deal with that at that time. So I think we're dealing in very theoretical circumstances that even justices find hard to articulate how it could violate people's Fifth Amendment rights. And what the U.S. Supreme Court has held in Fifth Amendment cases, and what the Alaska Supreme Court and Court of Appeals has held in Fifth Amendment cases, is we're talking about the real and substantial likelihood that you could be compelled to incriminate yourself. We're not talking about speculative situations, and that's the law with respect to the Fifth Amendment, and that's the balance that this tries to deal with. If one of these highly technical, theoretical situations arises, I'm sure that the courts of Alaska will take that into account and deal with it. But I just don't see that happening.
Okay, Senator French, another question?
Just while we're on the subject, quibbling with you, Mr. Guinella. I think your reading is right, but the Supreme Court was careful in Heibel to point out that there a case may arise where there is a substantial allegation that furnishing identity at the time of the stop would have given the police a link in the chain of evidence needed to convict the individual of a separate offense. In that case, the court can then consider whether the privilege applies and if the Fifth Amendment has been violated, what remedy must follow. And then they go on to say we need not resolve those questions here because that wasn't the rule of the case. I was just pointing out that there are dilemmas involved. I guess it's also worth noting that with respect to fingerprinting, the Heibel case mentioned that aspect of police work as well, and brought up a case called Hayes where the court suggested, didn't rule, but it suggested that Terry may permit, the Terry case may permit an officer to determine a suspect's identity by compelling the suspect to submit to fingerprinting only if there is, quote, a reasonable basis for believing that fingerprinting will establish or negate the suspect's connection with the crime. That is, if there's an evidentiary basis linking him to the crime and not simply establishing who that person is. So I guess that's just something else that's on my mind as I consider this bill.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, if I might, I just want to briefly touch on section one of the bill, and that is and why that is necessary. That is a change to the existing Alaska statute on contempt of court, and the contempt of court statute is one that really I have viewed as in need of amendment for a number of years. It for a couple of its provisions, it says that contempt of court is punishable by up to 6 months in jail, so it's a sort of a mid-level misdemeanor. But for most of its provisions, it says that contempt of court is only punishable by not more than $100 fine. And it says that it's only if the contempt of court prejudices a right or remedy of one of the parties that the greater penalty would apply. With respect to violating a subpoena that is issued by a court and served by a lawfully authorized process server or peace officer, I think we have a situation where the mid-level misdemeanor offense is appropriate. I think it's very difficult for anyone to prove that someone who violated a lawful subpoena that prejudiced a right or remedy of a party. In the case of a let's say a witness to a shooting who violates a subpoena to appear in the grand jury and just say who they are and what they observed. I think in order for the state to prove that that's anything more than a $100 fine, it would have to speculate as to what that person's testimony would have been, how material it would have been, and that it would have made a difference in the outcome of the case. And frankly, I think that is difficult, and that people ought to be held to a higher standard when they are issued subpoenas. So, in order to give some meaning to the subpoenas that are issued by the court, this provision in Section 1 says that that the provision in the existing law that says that it's contempt to violate a subpoena, that is punishable by the by that mid-level misdemeanor offense of up to 6 months in jail or a fine of $300. And that's the purpose of that.
Okay. I have a couple of questions, too, Dean, if I could.
Sure.
When I read this draft on the second section, it appears to me that if I read it at A1 and A2B are connected, that because A2B talks about person temporarily detained under A1, and then 2 and C are connected. And I really have a construction problem in how it flows, in that 2B refers back to A1.
Mr. Chairman, you're correct that A1 and subsection B go together.
And B, yeah, I'm not 2B, I'm sorry. A1 and then B, but I'm wondering if it wouldn't be easier. I guess it's a little confusing for me at first, and it's just a construction, and maybe I'm just not as sharp as the average knife in the drawer here. But it would seem to me that it would be easier to read if I had those connected somehow or another.
Mr. Chairman, I think that certainly A2 needs substantial restructuring in its subparagraph structure so that it's much more understandable as to what it does. And in doing that, I think it might be a good idea to then, you know, link it more, you know, more closely with subsection C. I mean, I think the cross-reference does that, but...
Yeah, it does, it does. It's just, you know, I think, I try to think of the average bear when they're trying to understand the statute. And you and I could probably connect that, but a lot of people might get confused. Because, in effect, you're if I read this correctly, you're saying that the person who is recently committed or is about to commit a crime has to allow their picture, has to have photo identification or fingerprinting. But if they're just a witness, they don't have to go through the fingerprinting process.
That's correct.
They just would have to, you know, and they don't even have to show government ID.
Correct.
So, you know,
and again, this
just
was
saying you got to have your picture taken.
Right, and this was, you know, my effort to do what Senator French urged, and that is to make a clear distinction between the law and what can be done regarding persons suspected of crimes and persons who are merely witnesses to a crime, and so that was an attempt to do that precise thing.
Yeah, I see that. I'm just thinking, you know, if we're going to redraft that paragraph, if there's a way to more simply tie those together so that we don't go from A1 to 2 to C and tie A1 to B, if there's a way to do that without... I know the drafters want us to save paper, but sometimes making it flow together might be more helpful.
I certainly agree, and I will have that discussion with the drafter.
Okay, other questions? Okay, I think we'll set this bill aside for now, and thank you very much. We'll just take about a 2-minute recess. back on the record. Senator Guest will be joining us in a moment. We're going to start with Senate Bill 92. And Derek? House Bill. I'm sorry. Senate CS for House Bill. Come on up, Derek. And,
good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Derek Miller, D-E-R-E-K, Miller, and I'm staff to Representative Mike Kelly, and I believe he'll be down when he gets a moment.
Okay, let's first of all look at, we have a Senate CS in front of us for consideration. It's identified in the upper right-hand corner as / X-ray, and Chair would entertain a motion to adopt X-ray.
We'll move X-ray at this time, Mr. Chair.
I'll object for purposes of explanation, and Derek, if you'll please explain to us the difference in X-ray.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, before you is...
Chairman, just a point of order.
We did that.
Yeah, I think this is before us, so I'm real careful about...
This one is before us?
Yeah, it's before us.
Okay,
in the last
I'm sorry.
Hearing. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, and
we'll void everything we did.
The explanation was given last time.
Right. They undid the changes in the House because they decided it was a misfire.
Correct, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Derek. Explanation.
I believe at the last meeting there's some concerns addressed, and I believe there might have been some legal questions that we were unable to answer at that point in time because there was no representative, a legal representative from the university to address those concerns. But I believe between that meeting and this meeting, those concerns were addressed as far as I'm aware.
Senator French?
I'll just report that the University Counsel, Ms. Green, sent me a nice memo about piercing a corporate veil. I'm sure she was responding to the questions that were posed to her. But my exact kind of concern was whether other states have adopted this model, and her memo didn't address that. But as I told my staff, and I think passed it on to Representative Kelly's office, you know, my concerns are not sufficient, I think, to hold the bill up. I was just trying to get an answer as to whether this is the way other states do it or whether we're just striking out on our own. You know, I'm in agreement with the basic thrust of the bill. I think it's a great idea. I think we need to encourage more, you know, public-private partnerships in this area. And so I'll just leave it at that.
Other questions on the bill? Anything else, Derek?
Not if there's any other questions. Well, I guess just to comment on Senator French through the chair. In minutes from last year that I read that a comment was made that this is the exact blueprint from what other universities or what other states have done.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other questions from members of on the bill? Is there anyone else that wished to testify on the bill? Seeing no one here, no one online, we'll close public testimony on the bill, and we'll just discuss the bill among the members. Is there discussion on the bill? Motion.
Mr. Chair, I just make the comment that you know, I salute this effort in the respect that it makes the university more self-sufficient and business model into place, which I think is a good thing for our state.
I like the bill because it's very clear. Anyone entering into a partnership, there's a statute that addresses the limit of responsibility and liability. I think it's a good move.
Okay, with that, Mr. Chair, I'll move that Senate CS for House Bill 92 move with attached physical note and individual comments.
Is there objection? Hearing none, this bill's moved on to its next committee of referral. Thank you very much for being with us this morning. Derek, we'll take a short recess. We're back on the record. Tomorrow, we will have a discussion on, we'll start the discussion on House Bill 318, which is the eminent domain bill, and we'll see how much time that takes, but, and we have several other things we can consider, but we'll start with also the confirmation of William Granger, Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar. So those two things are on our list for tomorrow. And I have to present a bill at 9 o'clock in finance. Won't take too long, but we'll get started and see where we go. And if you want to recess for a while or whatever, we'll do that. And with that, if there's nothing else to come from the committee today, it's now 10 o'clock, and we're adjourned for the day.